Hey people, welcome to another episode of Land and Life. I'm very excited about this episode. Hey! What is it, Bill?
Do you think, I don't know, I mean, I
just say it, spit it out.
I kind of wanted to introduce this one.
Okay, sure. Bill the Zombie is going to introduce our guest today on Land and Live. Bill, take it away.
Oh, like that?
Yep.
Okay, let me get my notes.
All right.
I'm ready.
Go ahead.
Okay. Philly native Michael Paul began his career in local television at age 16. Sustaining a 25-year comedy career, he honed his craft touring with such names as James Brown, Lisa Lampanelli, Wynonna, Joan Rivers, and Don Rickles. An audience with Queen Elizabeth II voted Atlantic City Magazine Act of the Year, becoming a headliner in over 40 countries, along with television credits on The Tonight Show, Saturday Night Live, America's Got Talent, and YouTube videos hitting over 12 million.
That's great, Joe.
Michael Paul's career includes motion pictures such as 27 Dresses, opposite Katherine Heigl. Is that how you pronounce it? I don't know. The 10, co-starring with Wynonna Ryder and Paul Rudd, and The Ventriloquist with Kevin Spacey.
Is that it?
There's more!
Oh, is there?
Also lending his voice to Pixar, Jim Henson Productions, and Disney, and is well known for creating branded puppet characters. I love puppets.
That's great, Bill.
Thanks. Known for creating branded puppet characters, including Nadia Coma, the world's oldest gymnast, and MTV's CJ and Peanut, as well as training casts of The Lion King and Avenue Q. Michael's published works include comedic editorials for USA Today, Huffington Post, Laughspin, and his all-star book, Breaking Out of Show Business, What I Discovered from Not Being Discovered, by Post Hill Publishing, can be found at numerous book outlets, including Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Behind the scenes, Michael has provided script coverage or directing for Netflix, ABC Digital, the Disney Channel, CBS Comedy Division, Robert De Niro. I need to take a break from this. Jennifer Hudson, Joshua Rush, Bradley Cooper, Tiffany Haddish punched up jokes for David Letterman, Bill Maher, the Comedy Central roasts, and he has taught at UCLA, NYC, Pace, SAG-AFTRA's Masterclass, and the Eugene O'Neill Conference. Michael resides in Los Angeles and continues to work in movies, television, and as a comedy writer, performance coach, and script and show consultant.
That was fantastic, Bill.
Here is Michael Paul on Land and Live.
Hello, and welcome to Land and Live. Today we have comedian, puppeteer, ventriloquist, director, and writer, Michael Paul. Michael, how are you today?
Hey, how are you? I like your theme music.
Thank you.
The band is great.
Yeah. Well, let's just go ahead and get right into it. What was the driving force that got you into show business?
Oh, my gosh. That's such a broad question. I had no other skills.
Okay.
I don't know. I think it's not an unusual story. You know, like most of us, we were doing shows in our basement, or, you know, you'd make the family come sit in the living room on the couch, and then you stand in front, you do shows for everyone. It was always like that since the beginning. But puppets... although I had done many things, puppets were always a thread for me. That was kind of like my first love. Even when I was, you know, could just start talking, it's really the only birthday present I wanted, you know.
Right. Wow. So did you always have puppets in your act as a ventriloquist, or was that a later decision?
You know, actually, I worked with puppets for when I was a kid. And, you know, I was like in, I don't know, second grade, and my parents bought me a little stage, and I would do like birthday parties and Cub Scouts and make like 25 bucks or whatever. My mom was my production manager, and she'd run the record, and we do little lip syncs and everything. Yes, the record, it's the big thing with the,
yeah.
And, you know, and then, you know, I got tired of being beat up all the time for, you know, playing with dolls and puppets. And, that kind of went away. I was like doing local, you know, acting and all of that. I had later been puppeteering for film and TV, even as a kid. And then I met Dan Horn, who you introduced. Okay. Well, first I met Ron Lucas. Mm-hmm. I had a summer job in Atlantic City when Atlantic City was still, you know, full of entertainment. And Ron Lucas was just starting to get really big. You know, if social media was back then, he would have been, you know, the Jeff Dunham of today.
Right.
So, I went up to Ron and I'm like, I'm working at some clothing store. I'm like, you know, 15 or whatever. I'm like, oh, haven't I seen you before? And he's like, well, you know, I hope so. I've been trying to break in the business for like 20 years now. So he was super nice. He kind of introduced me to it. And then years later, after not working with puppets for a while, I was doing stand up and I met Dan Horn. I was a stage tech. I was like 17 and a stage tech in a show he was in. And he said, you know, the comedy boom's hitting and everyone's just doing stand-up. Another guy in front of a microphone, you should put the puppets back in the act and it'll be more marketable. So I completely blame him for ruining my entire life.
Well, that's great. I hope he's able to tune in tonight.
He has apologized many times.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now you also worked with Sesame Street. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that influences your puppeteering today?
Yeah, sure. I think like most people who enjoy, you know, children's television or even just puppetry, you know, Jim Henson was a huge, you know, influence in so many different ways. You know, and I was, even when I was six, like I was stressed out that I wouldn't grow up fast enough to learn how to drive to get to New York to audition for the show. It would be off the air by that time. I was, you know, I was super Jewish and worried already. but through a series of events, I started working with them. I had met Jim Henson, but I never worked alongside of him. I was a kid with my parents on a tram car at MGM Studios. And the guy said, oh, and our studios to the left are being rented out by Jim Henson Productions. And I leaped off the tram while it was moving. I'm like, I'll meet you at the end, Mom. You know, and I crawled under a fence and I walked in and I'm like, oh, hi, I'm here to, I had a little voice. I'm like, hi, I'm here to see Jim Henson, you know? And they're like, yeah. Oh, well, how'd you get in? You know, he's not here right now. And then he walked in and we talked for a little bit. I'm like, oh, Mr. Henson, I'm going to work for you one day. Oh, I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to that. And he gave me his address and he said I could write to him. And eventually I got a letter from someone in the office. It wasn't him. And they paid for my bus ticket to come up to New York from Philadelphia to intern kind of and work in the workshop. I really wasn't a very good intern because all the interns were in college, you know, when I was like 4 years younger, I was not helpful at all. But years later, through a series of events, I was puppeteering with them for an amount of time. And yeah, it was great. I mean, it was very hard because some of them want you to be respectful of the history and the puppets and their superstars, and others don't want you to be a fan. It's a little Game of Thronesy at that time and even still today. But I was happy, you know, I got less time than some with that company and more time than most. So it was great. And yeah, it definitely telegraphed how I wanted to do the puppets in my act, you know. Only until recently did I purchase a hard figure. And I just knew that I wanted soft characters. I liked the ability of manipulation. It was a, you know, ventriloquism, it gets a really big eye roll from people. They don't really want to come to the show unless they're already there for something else. And so we have a lot of things that work against us. And one of those is projecting a sensibility visual or audio wise or comedically that the audience already knows. They'll be like, they'll check out and they say, oh, I already know what this is. I don't need to pay attention to this. So I really didn't want the wooden characters. Although it's funny because over the years when I have puppeteered for film and TV, like special effects, they always want the wooden character.
Because it's the typical run of the mill ventriloquist type stereotype they're going
for. Or when I go to audition, they want a ventriloquist for a commercial, they always want a wooden character. So I'd have to like borrow one from someone else to go do the audition, you know?
Wow, that's interesting. Are there any aspects to puppeteering? I know it's a totally different type of puppeteering when you're on stage and you're fully visible to the audience, but that you've, you know, maybe subtleties or nuances that you've taken and that you use on stage today.
Yeah, it's a very, you know, and I'm just speaking from a directorial standpoint, and sure. You know, it's only my opinion. And there's room for everybody and everyone can enjoy the art form, but it's a very small percentage of ventriloquists that are good, really good puppeteers, strong puppeteers. You know, there, because the rules of puppeteering for television are very different than the rules of puppeteering for stage. Eye focus and a broader manipulation, unless you're just recording your act on television, then you can do it however you wrote the act, you know.
Right, but so you have to play it bigger when you're on stage, is what you're
it's
saying.
It's bigger on stage. Your eye focus is different. But also, I think it worked better in my favor to work on television first, because my manipulation was very intricate and intimate. And it's better to have that in your vernacular first than broad and having to scale back. Okay. But it's the same as being an actor, like a theater actor. It's really big and mugs all over the place. And then you get on camera and they're like, can you be just about 80% less? And then you feel like you're not doing anything, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You talked a little bit about how you just now added the heart figure. Could you talk about that and what persuaded you to make that addition?
Can I just say, someone said, Landon, you need more light on your face. But actually, this is like a 2020 interview, so we don't really get to see what he fully looks like, because he's going to reveal something terrible about someone. I'm sorry, your question was about the heart, getting my new hard figure?
Yeah. You know, what was the – I don't know if I can
– I'll tell you what it was. I mean, the expense can be just the same. Sure. But the truth of the matter is they were heavy and I didn't want to carry them. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest thing. They're a pain, and you know, also most of them, if they're not custom made for you, they're not left-handed controls. Like I've made a career out of learning how to do weird curve arounds to manipulate you know.
Oh, that's right, because you're a left-handed puppeteer.
Right.
Wow.
Right. It's a pain. Yeah. So they're like, you know, none of the posts of this are made for lefties unless it's custom made. But also I found that you know, I don't know. I just thought that I had more ability and more shelf life with a character that was soft. Now, that being said, I really like the genre of manipulation with hard figures. You know, there's something very specific about that style of manipulation, which can, again, be done well or not well. But, you know, there's many ventriloquists who cash in on not doing it well, and that's their gimmick, right? That's what makes it so clunky and can't be funny. So just kind of have to know what you're watching,
whether they know that or not.
Right. I mean, sometimes they don't realize how hilarious they are, and some people who are like evil geniuses do know and don't telegraph to the audience that they really know.
Well, that's interesting. So what is this new character that you're talking about? Could you reveal?
Yeah. So in general, I have a lot of pet peeves about people's character development, my own included.
Sure.
There've been many characters, as you know, we've discussed this recently, that, you know, I have a great idea, but it's only a great idea in concept. And then it's a one trick wonder, you know, one joke, or just there's no shelf life or real meat to it, you know?
Right.
So I don't like generic characters. You know, it has to have a hook and also a storyline. Like, for instance, you know, I have the world's oldest gymnast. I never act familiar enough to this character like I know them, because in real life, I would never get the opportunity to really know this person unless you create a storyline that's way too much of a stretch for the audience. So I'm not old. I'm not athletic. I'm not, you know, professional in athletics. She's older than me. We won't relate to many things. I don't pretend that she knows my name. You know, it's almost like an interview, so it's a spontaneous introduction. I don't pull her out of a box, any of that stuff. So when it came to a wooden character, really, I just wanted, I had seen someone build one and it was a very unique look. It wasn't that it was overly designed, but it was a little on the anime side. You know, it wasn't the standard creepy eye look with the lock jaw, you know, and all that.
Right. something friendlier.
And I just really liked it. So I got it just to kind of play with. And, you know, generally the characters are created with a background. And, you know, I don't really love making the audience members try to remember a name. Hi, this is Billy. Hi, this is Chucky. You know, I think they don't really, no one remembers that. It's only important to the ventriloquist and it's dumb. So, you know, I did something kind of English. He is my nephew. So I'm like, he's like, uncle, can you do this? Hey, yes, nephew. You know, it's very formal. It's very English. Everyone remembers that it's my nephew. They don't have to remember some random name, you know, and it's been fun. You know, there's two ways I can go with it. I can be, you know, very clean and cute with it without being schmaltzy. And also it's never difficult to make, you know, an innocent character say naughty things.
Right.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, what was it like you got that character since you'd been working years with the soft ones?
Well, I'm not unfamiliar with working the characters, but any puppet, whether it's soft or, you know, hard figures, they all have their own abilities to manipulate. So, right, I mean, whether it's what your physical arm and hand allow you to do, what your motor skills allow you to do, and what the character can do. And sometimes the limitations of a character, what might seem like limitations in the build, might actually be good body language that helps with your character background and development. So with this one, actually there were a lot of build issues that, you know, I didn't get to see it. It was built by somebody else. You know, and I wasn't in the same town, but the price was right and I liked it, but there were a series of build issues. And although aesthetically, you know, very beautiful, I was surprised at how it was built and things that I thought the builder might know about. When I asked other people, had they utilized his services, they said, yes, and we love him, but they were people that don't work on stage with a microphone and, you know, they're working in a park with a bunch of homeless people watching them, you know, so.
A park or their, you know, Boy Scout event, you know, once every few years.
Which is awesome. Like I'm just saying that I couldn't get away with it. And technically it was very problematic. So I kind of don't want to put a ton of money into it, but I have a few people working on different parts that each builder has a specialty in, you know?
Sure. That's really neat.
But it's a great examination. Like it's so nice to work with something without the expectancy of a result. You know, it's like usually we're manufacturing comedy and characters and things to build the show. And you want it to be good, or people are going to be like, oh, he's lost it, or he never had it or whatever. But this is a really nice exploration that is really just for me. So it gives a lot of room, kind of like when you first start out and you do something just for the passion of it instead of because it has to pay your rent.
Sure. What's interesting in seeing you introduce this new character is that you've done a lot of videos for social media and gotten some good responses too.
I'll do one-off conversational things, and then I'll do little jokes and bits and whatever. And you know, it's too what many of us call too short to suck.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, could you talk a little bit about your favorite gig and maybe your worst or most difficult one that you can remember?
My worst gig is too long of a story, but it's in my book. Basically what happened was, everyone has their own style of humor. And I don't think one is any better than the other. A lot of people try to shame, performers when they have, you know, adult humor or even dirty shows, blue humor. And the truth is, and some people say, well, it's not creative writing. Well, it can be creative writing. It's not like they're just shouting the F word for no reason at all. That's not the most creative. Right. But I think funny is funny. And I think that comedy's under fire. And I think that's a misnomer. And it's a judgment that has no place in comedy. So, I bring that up to you because I had done many corporate events, not my thing though. Like I know what my audience is. I know where I flourish and I know where I enjoy the most. Sure. You can tweak things here and there to work for an audience. You are there to entertain. So you can't be like, well, if they don't get it, it's their problem. But you also don't have to put yourself in situations just to get paid for your art when it's not going to go well for anybody. Well, I was a little younger. I didn't really know that. And I had a CEO of a Fortune 500 company and his company and his wife see me in a casino show setting, and they wanted me to do their national stockholders meeting, which is like, you know, 10,000 people. It's a 3-day thing. And I had said, you know, I think what you and your wife enjoyed in the privacy of a casino show really is not great for this kind of company. It's a conservative company. It's a, you know, very Southern company, you know, and it's going to be great. Over a 6-month period, I had sent them footage to review to make sure they understood. And normally they had been used to having musical acts, and that's it. They never had an act where there were like cues and things like that. It was before technology where you could roll your own cues and all of that. I went in, I did an afternoon show that was easy and went well. And there's like television cameras, they're recording the whole thing. And then the next night I'm supposed to open for Amy Grant, which back then, before she was country, she was like a Christian music person. They were running late in rehearsals and they cut my rehearsal, which was not, you know, in the contract, you have to have a rehearsal. And then because the evening was running so long, they asked me to cut time. So I'm up there, I'm doing the act. I'm not sucking, but it's fine. The problem is when you're having a room that's 3 ballrooms long, they're supposed to have a delay system that can help it from slapping back so they don't hear it in 3 different parts. So that's what was happening. So then they would laugh here, then they'd laugh there, and then they'd laugh there. So it never sounded like I was really killing. But Amy Grant decided the whole evening was running long, having nothing to do with me, and they wanted me off, and she wanted to go on. So instead, because they'd never dealt with an act before, and they didn't know the act because they didn't let me rehearse, instead of giving me a cue or a flashing light or a stage manager or someone tapping me on the shoulder, they decided to stop playing my cues. So I thought, like any professional, that something was broken and they needed me to stretch until they fixed it. So I started doing more. And I'm like, how are we doing? No one's talking to me. They basically left me out to dry to the point where I had flop sweat. I ran out of material, and out of panic, I started doing a joke that was a little blue without language. I got one line in. The CEO bounds up on stage. He puts me in a headlock. There's like fire in his eyes. He pushes me on stage, kind of like I thought it was like a get out of here, you crazy kid thing. And then he proceeded to go in an evangelical tirade and call me trash for about 10 minutes. It was terrible. And my people and I, we grabbed our stuff. We were supposed to be paid the second half of our money. We were flying out the next day. The next day I had to walk through the hotel and be on the airplane with people. Some people thought he was a jerk. Some people didn't get what was happening. Some people thought I was a sinner and it was awful. And then I wrote them a fax, a 3-page fax, basically how they breached contract many times. He put his hands on me, and I expect to, you know, they didn't do what they said they were going to do. And I expect to be paid in 24 hours. So the sad part about it is there were other friends of mine that were attached to that company that had bad things happen to them because they were friends with me. So they did pay me immediately. It did scar me for a long time. Every time I heard a Southern draw or someone would say, are you family friendly or let me see your material, I would get stomach aches, until finally a famous comedian said to me, you know, you're not a limited performer just because you don't play every audience. Find your audience. As opposed to being a generic whatever, you know. But people were afraid of judgment, but you're always going to have that regardless. So that was the worst. I know everyone's probably depressed right now and needs a drink, but you know, it really I did everything I knew how to do to keep that from happening, except for not taking the job. But when someone says at 26 or whatever it was, you know, name your price, you know, you want to take the risk.
Jump on it. Yeah.
Right. The best gig, there were so many of them. You know, I remember I finally played Las Vegas and I had done the show and I did really well. And they were doing a sequel to that production show, which was singers and showgirls and a comedy guest star. They were doing it the next summer and there were 2 acts in the show. And I was the headlining act. And then they didn't ask me back for the next show. Maybe I might've been too expensive or something. I don't know why. Yeah, right. So finally it's the last 3 weeks of the run of the show. And they asked me to close out the show. And at the end of my act, at the end of the show, you come down the big staircase for your bow, and the audience stands up, and it is a wall of applause and cheering. And I felt it like go through me. And I thought, and I was young, and I thought, okay, I know what I'm doing now. I have made it. And then afterwards, they're like, we haven't heard an audience like that all summer.
Wow.
So that's kind of when I never forgot that. It was my big aha moment. Yes, I'm doing something right. I'm okay. Mm-hmm. And also that I was coming into my own. You know, people had mentored me a lot, and I really had a lot of guilt about that because, you know, we mimic when we mentor, and I wanted to be, and we're all going to have a little remnants of other people, but I wanted to be my own. So that was that.
Do you have any pre-show rituals?
Yeah. It's kind of the same all the time. I unpack the same way. I set up the props the same way. I put on my clothes the same way. I put on my mic the same way. I need about 10 minutes to myself or 8 minutes to myself before the show. That being said, there have been times where there's an emergency and I was thrown out on stage, and that adrenaline made it a kick-ass show. But generally, I need some quiet. I need about 5 minutes of quiet before I go on in the wings. I really don't want people to talk to me, only because it's weird. Like, I might do the same opening joke every show for a year, but I have to say the joke to myself before I walk out to whatever that first line is. And if I walk out to the mic or walk out on stage and I like trip or get sidetracked or whatever, and I like stumble on that first line, it's a mess for like 10 minutes. Like, for some reason, even though it's the same joke, I still need to concentrate on what that line is, you know?
Right.
And I do vocal warm-ups just like a singer because, you know, the characters' voices are tough, especially when you're flying all night and you're all dried out and you know, things like that. So, yeah.
Wow. Wow.
But I don't pray or anything, but I try to, sometimes I'll just try to say, not psych myself out about the, oh, and I always look at the audience too. I always like to look at the audience.
Okay.
Yeah. To see who's out there.
Yeah. That's great. What advice do you have to comics working today or who want to work in the future?
I think any comedy act, a couple of things. One, don't move to a town that's known for comedy. That's a bad place to start. Why go where everyone's doing it? Start locally and become a local staple. Acts only get good when they're on the road, you know, not doing the big gigs or being in the big pool. Every little gig you can get, you know, open mic nights aren't great, because generally you're working to other people wanting to perform. So they're not paying attention, or they're not laughing, or they're writing down your joke. So it's not a great assessment, but if you have nowhere else to go, that's what you should do. So start locally. I think that most acts, for some reason, variety acts in particular, they start with stock stuff. I could do this. I could execute that. That feels like me. You know, a lot of magicians do that when they start. I'll put this trick together, but I'll do it wearing a hat, you know. And I find that after you come into your own and you have to let all that drop away and write your own act again, it's harder to do it later, which everyone seems to do. If you start in the beginning with your own original stuff, yeah, it feels like you don't know what you're doing, but you're not going to know what you're doing when you have to redo it 5 years later. So I would say start on your own. I don't tell anybody your jokes except for other professionals, because everyone could be like, I guess if that's what you think is funny, you know. It's so that's two. Three, don't try to be so creative in your writing. If you write about what you know about and what's the most you in how you deal with other people internally, externally, physically, then that'll be relatable, funny humor that the audience gets. And it's the most you, and it's not generic. So all the information you need for good material, you already know about, because we're people that walk through life and look at people and judge people and know what makes us sick or makes us laugh or makes our palms sweaty, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's absolutely great advice. What is your biggest ventriloquist pet peeve?
Oh my God. There's
kind of switching the gears here.
There's too many.
All right. We'll go with your top five or three.
Okay. So let me just say, it's going to sound like I'm judgmental, and I'm not calling anyone out or not including myself. Okay, I just want to be clear.
Sure, but there are things, there are things that you make sure that you're probably not doing in your act so you look more polished.
Obviously there's things that technically we all have to keep our eye on. You should always be videotaping yourself every couple of months in case you're becoming casual and dead when the puppet's moving or vice versa. Even the best ventriloquists have that problem. Eventually, your lift might not be moving, but you're getting an old man neck and your neck moves. Are there other ways, your Adam's apple, are there other ways around that? So that kind of stuff, of course. I hate a character that's generic, like, oh, I have a bunny. Okay, well, so what? The material could be given to any other puppet you have. Why is there a bunny there? Is it a pet bunny? Did you buy it for your child? And then if it was rabid, and I'm not talking about punt, not rabbit, rabid, like, you have a lot of, is that me or is that you? Why do they, my people, they never FaceTime me. They never tell me when they're going to FaceTime. Sorry. So, this is technology on the internet. So character development, why is the puppet there? Without a whole long explanation, it doesn't make any sense. Bad character development, that's my issue, one. Mm-hmm. Not just, here's my buddy, I'm pulling him out of the box. Now, granted, like, Dan has Orson come out of the box, but it's kind of charming because Orson was in vaudeville. It's a vaudeville case. Dan has this kind of old-timey feel to it, so it kind of works, you know what I mean? So that's
yeah, and he explains the relationship, too. It's not, something the audience has to figure out at all.
Right. Exactly. Now, have they been have they been traveling together a while? I don't know. Do they know each other? Whatever. So that brings me to my next point. That stereotypical scripting format of set up punchline, where I can feel the punchline coming from the puppet. It's not conversational. The issue is it could be hip material, but if you're formatting it like you're doing burlesque or vaudeville, that's why people roll their eyes at ventriloquists. It's no matter how hard you took to write the joke, it still comes off as hokey. Mm-hmm. So that's number two.
Well, I want to say, while we're at number two, that one of the biggest pieces of advice you've given me in my writing is to, looking at it from a ventriloquist and a comedy point of view, is to not write where you're setting up questions that the puppet has to answer and make it more like a conversation, like you would talk to a person. And it sounds so obvious until you look back at your writing, you're like, yeah,
nobody does that.
And now whenever I write, I go back over all my questions and I'm like, is this question essential or can I reword it?
So we had a conversation about you and your character, Mervin, and you're asking him questions. I'm like, okay, but someone your age wouldn't be interested in even knowing about that. So how is that coming up that you're talking about it? Either he brings it up, you saw something happen. Why do you have to hang out with him? Why would you? There's nothing relatable. And then I made you answer those questions, right? So I'm not saying there's nothing there. You can't utilize it. Mm-hmm. But when the audience senses that you're setting the character up for the bit, it's awful. It's like the worst ventriloquist BS that is – it's lazy and it's terrible.
Even worse if the punchline is a pun.
The worst. Now, Dan loves puns. Now, I would say for puns, either very sparingly or I know a puppeteer improv guy who walks out in a police officer's uniform and he pulls out a loaf of bread with a little officer's hat, like they're partners, and all he does is about 20 minutes of bread puns. And it is so friggin' funny. It's the funniest because you think it couldn't go any further and you just have to either leave or accept it. So it's all about the exaggeration and the comedy, right?
Sure.
So, because we already have enough against it. So is there anything else ventriloquist-wise that I hate? I have one. Mm-hmm. So technique. Now, Ron and Dan taught me that it's a mixture of two things. Aside from leaving a space so you can, it's not muffled, relax your face. Not this gritting thing. How are you? Good. How are you? That to me telegraphs, it pulls focus from what you're doing. It looks crazy as a person. If you just stood there like a person and acted like that, it looks crazy. It doesn't sound clean. And frankly, anyone could do it, right? Yeah. There's no technique to that. Now, the other side to that is too much of this dead face is also a problem, right? So you got to make sure your life. Like I was practicing with that nephew puppet and he's saying something to me. And I looked at the video and I got in the habit of having dead face. I wasn't like doing any smile or looking away or any of that stuff. So, you know, we all are guilty of that. But that technique that people teach the younger kids, I don't get it.
Yeah. And you know, what's odd is that you see that in a lot of like pageant ventriloquists, they always do that smile. And it's like, you know, they've got the two boy and girl puppets and they're going back and forth and they've got the smile and it's like the same
how
song.
Are you?
And
you like, guys good? How are you?
Yeah.
Now, it's like this, to bash myself, the bird of prey was not that at first. And when I first made it, the voice I gave it was the same voice that every ventriloquist uses for one of their characters, that nasally, gritty, hi, how are you thing. Now, why did I do it? It was easy for my register. It sounded different for me. I didn't know enough about ventriloquism to know that everybody does that voice. So, you know, when I hear it, I still feel like, ugh, I can't really joke about it because, you know, well, I'm not going to change the voice after 30 years, you know, but I give myself a little bit of a pass because I try to make the other areas not so ventriloquist terrible, you know.
Sure. I'm sure that the fact that it's a, you know, this giant colorful bird kind of takes away from that.
I don't know. That only works for about 2 minutes in. You know, it's like, you know, I used to wear bright, fantastic suits with white sneakers in the 80s and 90s because if my material was bad, they like my suit, you know. But that only lasts for 2 minutes.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Can you talk a little bit about your brand as a performer? Because it's very clean and very fluid throughout all the platforms and how long it took you to create that? Because I think that's another important thing that most entertainers don't focus on.
Yeah, I think that my brand has changed a lot over the years. You know, when I first started, and also, by the way, entertainment branding was very, very different in like the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. Back then, it was billboard worthy, flashy, really fun, interesting graphics. You know, I used to have one where I was in a spotlight, but the image of the shadow was the old vent Haven ventriloquist top hat with his knee on the chair with the dummy silhouette, you know, and things like that. I believe in catchphrases. You know, my friend Ivan Pacell, international juggler, people roll their eyes at juggling just like they do ventriloquism. His is Ivan Pacell making juggling tolerable. You know, I think all of that is really good. I direct a lot of acts and they don't have a brand. And one of them is a magic team. They're super generic. And I said, well, what do people know you for? I don't know. Well, what do people say about you after the show? Nothing. Okay, great. Maybe that's your thing. It's just what you think it's going to be. So, you know, I changed a lot over the years. You know, my stage name was Michael Ziegfeld for many years. And I was a Ziegfeld Folly, a true Ziegfeld Folly, which is a play on the Follies, right?
Yeah.
So, but you know, but that was very Las Vegas-y. It was very schmaltzy, which is okay back then. But in today's world, that kind of showy, show business-y thing doesn't really work in Hollywood. It was hard to spell. No one could find it on social media. But I do think branding's super important. I think your name is a logo in itself, and that name should be all over your branding, whether it be your stickers, your envelopes, your emails, your social media. It should all match, of course. And a play on words is good. I also have always battled with, do you put the puppets on the poster? For me, I never did that. I was a stand now, and that could be to my disadvantage. You know, people love the puppets and that's great merchandise and all of that. And a lot of times they don't remember the ventriloquist, but they remember the puppet, right? So
People
say, what's the guy's name with Ahmed the terrorist? You know, they never remember Jeff's name or the other way around. But for years, I was a comic first, and I decided that the puppets are my props. I am the product. I am the personality, so to speak. So I never put the puppets on the program or on the marquees because I didn't want to telegraph the surprises in the show. Mm-hmm. Also, like I said, if I don't know the gymnast, then why is she on the – it was that kind of weird acting.
Right. No, that's very fluid throughout your whole – presentation and performance.
I mean, you can have remnants of the, like all of a sudden you see like I did one where it was just feet. It was my feet and the puppets, all the puppets' feet, you know, so it doesn't really say who everybody is. You can tell there's a ventriloquist puppeteer.
And there's a mystery in there. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's many everything in the kitchen sink. It was like a sink with like me like this and different puppet parts sticking out, you know, or like the Olympic medal was hanging over and things like that. So that's just my feeling on it. I never really enjoyed Michael and Skippy, you know, or whatever the puppet is. Not that it's wrong. It's just not my style, you know. It's also a little old.
Yeah, totally. Now, you were on AGT. What season were you on?
AGT? I was in season 14 last year.
Okay. Yeah. What was that experience like? Because
I loved it and I hated it. I mean, it wasn't like when I was supposed to be on when I did the Tonight Show or Premium Blend where they want you to succeed. You know, I ignored that show for 14 years. And they asked me, like many of my cohorts, many, many times, because, you know, in the end, I'm a nightclub act. I'm a comedian. My material has a very slow burn to it. And I just didn't think it was my medium. But also, you know, everyone knows when they go on that show that you have very little control on how they cut it. So I knew based on what they wanted from me, like my strength is my improv. My strength is my stand-up. The puppets are really so sprinkled throughout the show as accents, but in the limited scope they wanted to use me, I knew I wouldn't go very long. So, you know, I asked many friends, do I really need to do season 14? Is this going to help me at all or just put me through a lot of misery? I really never liked the show or any of those shows. I don't think creativity should be involved in competition. I think it poisons the well. And I think it's bad. I think it's, I don't think competition helps anyone's art form at all. So, and it hurts other people. So, but eventually, yeah, everyone said the same thing. No one remembers if you do good or bad. It's a credit, you know, it's in today's vernacular and so on and so forth. So, you know, fortunately, because I had a production background, you know, they were very, I knew how to weave around a lot of the pitfalls where they tried to, you know, get you to say or do things and then change it later on air. You know, they can ask you a question and you say yes, and then they make it sound like you said no. So, you know, I knew I'd only be on twice. The social media aspect was really overwhelming and impressive. I mean, of course, the minute you're off the show, you lose like, you know, 5,000 people. But, you know, it was weird. Like, I was getting emails and social media calls from people in prison that wanted to do bad things to me in a good way for them. And men that are and women that are in marriages that wanted to marry me. And I was huge in Iran, you know, I mean,
wow,
huge in Iran, you know, so
that you know, could be your new slogan, Michael Paul, huge in Iran. Yeah.
So, and people were just as wonderful as they were terrible, you know, you know, people on YouTube were absolutely vicious and some were absolutely amazing. You know, you get people that are like, you saved my life. I committed suicide and now I want to live, you know, things like that. So it was wonderful and terrible at the same time. I think the hardest part is that, you know, you're doing 2 minutes on network television and then people think that's what you do for a 55 minute show. You know, the second round, they cut it to make it look like I failed. I did not fail in the actual recording, you know, in the actual studio, but they did not set me up for success. There were some hardships that took place before I went on stage that had nothing to do with me, but you know, that's part of the beast. A lot of people don't know that. They think that what you're looking at is really happening and that's how it happened. So, you know, it was fine for what it was and I still get PTSD from it, but I think that my response videos were got a lot of great accolades and, you know, you try to do it with grace.
Yeah, completely. I can totally relate to, you know, putting yourself out there. And because it's like whenever you offer up creativity to the public, they're, you know, you're going to have the good and the bad. So it's, you know, taking it, filtering it, and then going, okay, I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing, or I'm going to actually take this to heart a little bit. So,
right. I mean, it was hard to really, from a production standpoint, from a, you know, a marketing standpoint, all you really have to do is get one or two good credits and a few, you know, stills. And that's part of your package. People go see people from AGT that were absolutely bombed. There's a whole show whole show called the AGT Rejects, you know? So, and since then everyone wants me to do those reality shows and I really have no interest in doing it again. There's one in Australia that I will continue what I was getting ready to do because it's a more of a positive experience, but I did it, and I never need to do it again, you know.
Sure, sure. Well, I'm curious. Earlier, we had talked about branding and knowing your audience. Who would you define your audience as being?
Well, I mean, there's certain jobs that pay your bills, and there's certain jobs that I can do the material that I feel like is the most me for experimentation. Most people, comedians anyway, have the luxury, hopefully, of finding something that's both of those things. And, you know, I started in a different world. You know, I mean, that back in the day, ventriloquists and variety acts played the role of the ventriloquist. They were dressed well and they were the straight man. And that's not what audiences want now. They want to know you. And fortunately, you know, I have made that jump in many ways, but the venues I play, you know, the venues that would allow me to do that don't really pay. So, you know, my audience, I know how to do, I would say 30s through 90s, 90 year olds, you know. Okay. I love children, and I've had kids in my show here and there. I am not a kids performer. People think because there's puppets that, and not that I'm dirty. I just talk about things that I relate to, you know. So I do great with a few kids in my audience, but they're not my audience. And I don't take a lot of pleasure in it. If there's, you know, 500 kids, I just won't do it, 'cause that's not my style of humor.
Sure. Sure.
Well,
you've done, everything from online shows to cruise ships. Can you talk a little bit about the differences in that?
Yeah. you know, a career is a career. I think that, you know, people can badmouth either that cruise ships pay great, but you don't have a life, or maybe it's not real show business, or land is terrific, but everyone tries to screw you. I mean, there's a positive and a negative. And I think that, you know, people like have this weird dangling carrot. I got to play Las Vegas. Well, the truth is, you know, Las Vegas, that it doesn't pay. You know, no one comes to see Las Vegas. Everyone's paying for their own rooms. You know, go do the nonsense, or the money, or the accolades you get nowadays in Las Vegas which is a bubble, are the same that you'll get in Billings, Montana, if you're a big deal over there. So, you know, the negotiating's a little different. The cruise ships, everyone thinks, the truth is, the cruise ships are the hardest audience to play, because one, as anyone will tell you, nobody there came to see you. You are one of many pieces of programming. That's number one. So it's a much harder effort to win people over, number one. Number two, the cruise lines are generally, the bookers are not show business people. They went to school for hotel management or things like that. So unfortunately, they're the people in charge. So they get to weigh in, or try to weigh in on what you're doing, which generally does not help your success. Whether it
is
be
that like regarding material, or
it could be anything. It could be okay. Material. It could be the person on board, the hotel director, sets up several other programs that are happening at the same time as yours, or they walk in and they say, you're running your sound too loud. And then they want it to be like elevator music, or they want to put on some, you know, little campy sketch that the staff is doing before you go on, or any of those things that really don't help your brand. And that people will shrug about. Now, sometimes you got to let go and be like, okay, look, on a cruise ship, they only have so many people. You got to be a team player. You know, it's a little campy, and know your audience, and don't be a hard ass about it. The other side to that is, it's corporate entertainment. It's not show business. So if you can live with that and let go a little bit, then good for you. Then great. It can be great for you. Land, the other issue with land, I don't know. I love them. I know how to do both. I get a lot less nonsense with land. Although, you know, if you're not working a legitimate theater and it's like, you know, like a ballroom or a college, whatever, for some reason, they all want to set the chairs like 40 feet away from you, which is like the worst thing they could possibly do. Why do they think that we want that? It's like You're watching TV. So, you know, there's always production hardships as far as producing your act as well. That's all. I mean, the money, I never want to get paid the most, but I do want to get, because then you're a luxury, but I do want to be paid the upper middle. So you're respected and they feel like they're paying for something that's worthwhile. And you're asked back. They have a bunch to ask you back. Did that help? That was a lot of stuff.
Yeah, that did. And I want to ask you a quick question because I have one on what you just talked about, getting paid. How did you know, how did you feel confident in what you were asking for your act? Was there a time where you're like, yeah, I feel confident in this, or, you know, oh, I could do what they do. I'd price this because I know I could do it better. Like, what was your thought behind that?
It depends on your track record. It depends on how experienced you really are. Look, we all think we're ready. Mm-hmm. Really ready, and then you do it, you're like, oh, I wasn't ready. Or you look at somebody else, you know, or you look at your tape from like 3 years ago, you think, oh, I thought I was the bomb and I was not good, you know. In the beginning, you really just want to get paid. So if you're being paid $50 to go do 15 minutes so you can be in front of an audience and figure out who you are, great, you should do that. Later on, people will, you know, you can do a little homework and ask other people, say, I don't want to know what you make, but can you give me a range? Or an agent might say, listen, you're a new act. You have no credits. Here's what they pay first. And then we can discuss a raise. And eventually you make friends. You ask other people. Then later on it changes. Like sometimes you don't know. Like the venues in Florida, like the over 55 communities, I find that people play those at the beginning of their career or at the end sometimes. And you know, they're a little hokey, but they can pay. Some of them pay a lot. Some of them pay a little. Some of them, the agent tells you they pay a little, but they bill a lot and then they take half the money. And you just got to know what smells right to you. And the other thing is, if you're an established act, what's the number, if I don't know what they're making on the other side and they might be cheating me, I got to pick a number that I know I can live with, not knowing what they're going to be making on the other side. If I know this is, could be high maintenance, or they're going to be difficult, or set me up for a lack of success in the setup, or the audience sucks, or whatever, I'm going to be, you know, schlepping a long way. I got to pick a number where even if any of that happens, I'm not going to feel resentful. And that's my answer.
Okay. Wow. Wow. Fantastic. And kind of wrapping up here, I want to talk about your book.
Oh, hey,
breaking out of show business. What I've discovered by not being discovered.
Yeah.
Fantastic book. I've read it cover to cover. Thanks. Could you talk a little bit about what inspired you to write it and the feedback you've gotten from the public as they've gotten their copy?
Right. So I would say about 5 years ago, I was going to quit performing and quit this and just have some kind of a normal life. I didn't like where my career was at. I didn't like the money. I didn't like what was available to me. I was bored. You know, you create new stuff and then you do it and then you're stuck where you're back where you, and I was just not, everything had stalled and I wasn't happy for a multitude of reasons. So I was frustrated and tired and I was going to quit everything, all the aspects of what I do. By the way, are we talking about my social media, Michael Paul Live? You can find me there and all the background stuff at michaelpaulonline.com.
Okay.
So you can see the other things I'm doing, but I was going to quit and a publishing company approached me and they said, we understand you're wrapping up your, you know, 25, 30 year career and we'd like you to write a book about it. I said, well, who's going to care about a book from someone that no one's heard of? That's my whole life, a series of successful one-offs and nothing ever happened from it. And I kind of skyrocketed to the middle and they said, yeah, you have five different careers, you know, writing and puppeteering and all that stuff alongside all these famous people and no one knows who you are. And we find that very interesting. I said, really? Because I find it horribly annoying. So, but it was very fruitful. You know, I wrote this book, a series of, you know, stories, not just show business, juicy show business stories, but also how I would do things great or do things terribly and shoot myself in the foot. And then at the end, I said goodbye, you know, that I'm quitting. So then about the next year, I had like this breakthrough, this life breakthrough, where I figure out how to make my life happy again in many different ways. And so I was still performing. And so when the book went into reprint, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and all that, we wrote an epilogue, which is explaining why I'm still here and what I discovered from that. So yeah, we got a lot of great reviews, you know, from celebrities as well as, you know, Huffington Post and The New Yorker and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, no one gets rich off books, but it was a great exercise. And, you know, it was a wonderful experience and people seem to love it. Entertainers like, oh my God, you're telling my story. Oh my God, I never knew that about that person. Or, oh my God, how did you deal with that? Or that's a great idea. There's the University of Chicago psych department is utilizing one chapter that I use talking about how to disarm people on the phone and get them to do what I want or take my calls and things like
that. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's been really fun.
Yeah, wow, fantastic. What do you hope to see from future comedians and ventriloquists? Oh, wait, hold on. Wait, where can our audience get a copy of this book?
Yeah, so it's on Amazon, it's on Barnes & Noble, most of your outlets, and it gives you a little synopsis of all the show business stories and things like that, like when James Brown took me to the movies, when Ben Affleck tried to beat me up, when I saved William Shatner, Rodney Dangerfield, Donald Trump, Rosie O'Donnell, they're all in there. If you go to michaelpaulonline.com and you email us, I can sign it and we can send you a PayPal link and you can pay for it that way. And signing it, it'll be worth even less.
Well, and in concluding our interview here, what do you hope to see from future comedians and ventriloquists?
Yeah, I'd like to see everyone, again, if they are creating an act that looks like what they've seen before, then do something else. If they're used to seeing a puppet on a little stand, put it somewhere else. If they're used to seeing a puppet come out of the box, do it a different way. If they're used to seeing an old man, an old character puppet, why is it old? What is it doing? What, you know what I mean? And integrate yourselves into the comedy club world, sure. Not just the variety act world. And that'll make everything a lot better and help everyone else.
All right. Fantastic. Michael Paul, thank you so much for being part of Landon Live and for sharing some tips and your story.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking me. Take it easy.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.